So we have our six internal ayatana, six external ayatana. If, for instance, any one of these is not functioning, so we have a problem with our eyes, we have eyes that have the eye nerves are not working. Even if there's a sight available, rupa is available, no sense impression would arise. Similarly with the ears and the sound, if our ears somehow were not functioning, the nerves were damaged, even if a sound was available, there would be no sense impression arising. Similarly with the nose and smell, tongue and taste, skin and tactile objects. So these internal and external ayatana have a very important relationship. Each one has its object, and the jitta is like at the center. All the sense impressions experienced by the ayatana come down to the jitta in the end, whether it's from the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch, or from the mind itself, different objects arising internally in the mind. Because of this, if the mind is not calm, concentrated, firm, with the presence of mindfulness, then it will easily be affected by each sense impression which comes to it. It'll be affected, the sense impression will be a cause for either greed or anger or delusion to arise if mindfulness is not established. So without mindfulness, without samadhi, without panya, we could say the mind is weak and unguarded or unprotected. And this is why we come to practice. So we're learning how to build protection for our mind through the development of mindfulness and insight. And you could say this is developing an internal refuge. Or even you might compare it to a house, like building a strong house with strong walls to protect you. Your development of mindfulness, samadhi and then insight is like building a house with strong walls to protect the mind. So it's our internal abiding place or dwelling place. This is why Ajahn Chah used to ask, do you know where your true abiding place is yet? Have you found it yet? When there is mindfulness present, there is samadhi present, then the mind will feel cool, calm, peaceful. Any sense impression that comes its way will be met with mindfulness. The mind will know that sense impression and won't necessarily be shaken by it or swayed by it. And if mindfulness and insight is well established, there'll be no sense of self arising with that sense impression. There'll be no attachment, so no greed, no anger, no delusion will arise. When samadhi is firm, this quality of mindfulness will be as if close by to the heart, to the mind, to the jitta. It will be staying with it all the time, so any sense impression that arises from moment to moment will be known by mindfulness. In effect, what happens is you have a separation between the mind with sati, you could say the knower, and then the aramana, the object or the sense impression that is known. Mindfulness gives this sense of separation, and this is what protects or guards over the mind, stops it falling into a suffering from attachment. Sense impressions, you could compare a bit like the effect of coloured dye on water. If you have a bucket of water and you pour some coloured dye into it, well, the colour will change. Even though the colour, the dye and the water are not the same thing, but in effect the water becomes the colour of the dye. So mindfulness helps to separate then between sense impressions in the mind, because normally sense impressions in the mind is mixed together and we can't see anything. We can't see the two things, we can't put them in their two places, as it were. sense impressions then are what cause us to become angry, greedy, deluded. If mindfulness and wisdom is enough, we can separate between the jitter and its impressions. So think about it. When monks go to practice in the forest, what are they doing? They're going out to test, to build up their mindfulness and test them, themselves out in this way. When you go and stay in the forest, you might be worried, nervous, scared about the presence of snakes, tigers, other dangerous animals. You might have the feeling of loneliness, the fear of disease, fear of ghosts, and so on. But if your mindfulness and wisdom is developed sufficiently enough, your mind will be firm even in a lonely, frightening place. If mindfulness and wisdom is weak, then of course there's no, as if there's no buddho present in the mind, in that the mind, the quality of the knowing, the awareness is not there. Fear can arise very easily. Fear arises, it takes over the mind, and what does it do? It proliferates the mind and as if adds on suffering to the mind as it arises. If fear arises, Ajahn Chah used to say, ask yourself, is there anywhere in this world that people can't die or are not subject to death? And just because you're in a forest, you might think, oh, if I go back home, I'll be happy, I'll be well. But think about it. Most people don't die in the forest, and you die at home or in the city, some places like that. There's nowhere in the world that you can escape from death. You can die anywhere. So you bring that contemplation up just to calm yourself and you realize, well, you're not worse off in the forest or anywhere else. Death is coming for sure anyway. What we have to do is start contemplating. We start contemplating to see the nature of body and mind. The physical and mental phenomena are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. As we contemplate in this way, clarity arises, insight arises. We see the emptiness of these things, we empty of self, and this is what frees the mind from attachment to, and frees it from greed, anger, and delusion. Once samadhi arises, the mind doesn't rush after sense impressions, doesn't become deluded by things. It sees everything just as it is. It sees the body as the body, a sense impression as a sense impression. The mind doesn't get caught up with these things, and that's notion of self, the feeling, the sensation of self, this being me, mine, myself. Us and them, a body, a mind, a person, a being, that fades away and is just knowing. This is what we call vipassana panya, insight meditation, insight wisdom, where the mind sees itself, the jitta, and the object both as not self, without self. Sees the body as not self, sees the mind as not self. Whenever the practice of samadhi is well developed, the mind is firm, then we can contemplate in this way. We can contemplate to see body as body, feelings as feelings, the jitta as jitta, dhamma as dhamma, mind objects as mind objects. We can see all of them as anicca, dukkha, anatta. Ajahn Chah pointed out that, of course, when you practice and develop samadhi, when it becomes strong, you can use the mind for many different tasks, not just for vipassana. You can use it to perform miracles, develop psychic powers, psychic knowledges, and make holy water, bless people, and so on. But obviously the purpose of the Buddhist path is to develop insight through the development of vipassana, to help us to give up our attachment, to see the true nature of phenomena as anicca, dukkha, anatta, to see these five khandhas as anicca, dukkha, anatta. So we use the mind that is calm with samadhi to contemplate this body. If your character is that you're one who thinks a lot, worries a lot, doubts a lot,
fall into anxiety and so on. Contemplate death a lot. Use that as a meditation object. Contemplate that your death is the only thing that is really certain, that you can really be sure of in life. Just like a cow in a farm where they raise cattle for slaughter, for a beef production, you know, that cow walking around the field, it knows it's destined or it's doomed to die in the slaughterhouse, and so every step is like a step closer to the slaughterhouse. Really, our life is like that. Every step we walk is a step closer to death. So contemplate it in that day, in that way. Why give in to greed or anger or delusion when death is certain? You're going to die anyway. There's no need to give in to these kilesas. When we die, we don't take anything with us from this world. The objects of our greed, our anger, our delusion, we don't take with us. So if we are to die for sure, what's the point of getting angry anyway? What's the purpose? Think about what happens when we do die. If the mind is overcome by greed, anger, and delusion, it'll be in an unwholesome state. What would happen then? If we're experiencing a lot of negative karma at our death, well, most likely be reborn in a negative realm, what we call the Abhaya Bhumis, the four realms of despair, animal realm, ghost realm, hell realm. But if we practice and develop mindfulness and use the theme of death as a recollection, an object of recollection, it prevents the mind from falling into unwholesome states of greed, anger, and delusion. So we have to keep recollecting death and remembering that theme, bringing the mind to that, paying attention to it over and over again. And as we do this, we can look at the world that we're involved with. We're involved with the world through our senses and see, well, what's the point of attaching to the world? The world is just a cause of greed, anger, and delusion. And when we die, we have to leave this world anyway. So you might as well leave it now with your meditation. I mean, let go of your attachment to the world and free your mind from suffering. As long as we keep attaching to the world, we will keep suffering. So really contemplate this point. And if we develop sati and samadhi and panya and learn how to contemplate, this is what will free the mind from greed, anger, and delusion. The mind that is free from greed, anger, and delusion, what's that like? Well, it's a mind that doesn't want anything from the world, doesn't expect anything from the world. Instead of spending its time to build up wealth in the world and connections to the world and try to obtain the things of the world, the mind is more interested in developing internal wealth, the Ariyasattva, the internal spiritual wealth that comes through the practice of Dhamma. We really need this kind of internal spiritual wealth or noble wealth for our future. And we have to develop the path of Dana, Sila, Bhavana, in order to develop the causes for our happiness, for our peace of mind. If our character is more one who tends towards sensuality, sensual indulgence, you like beautiful things, you like to think about things that are beautiful, attractive, then contemplate the body a lot. Do a lot of gayagada sati, body contemplation. When we ordain as a novice or a monk, you know, the first thing we're taught is how to contemplate the body. We give them the five basic meditation objects, Kesa, Loma, Naka, Danta, Tacho. We learn how to recite them forward and backwards, meaning we learn how to contemplate and concentrate our mind on these objects very thoroughly, in forward and reverse order, until we become very familiar with them. We learn to contemplate the body in the body, the external body and the internal body. The external body, well, you're contemplating the body of other people. You're analysing and seeing other people as hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. Then you turn back to look at your own body, these external objects, and then move into your own inner body. Move inwards and contemplate the body organs, the bones, the lungs, the spleen and so on. really learn to focus the mind on them, visualize them, see them for what they are. They're not attractive. We contemplate the 32 parts and see how they're made up of the four elements. There's the solid parts, the liquid parts. The liquids you can divide into urine and pus and blood and etc. It's all made up of the liquid elements, the solid parts, the bone and so on, the earth elements. All of this we can see in the light of, or as unattractive, whether you're just contemplating an individual body part, one of the 32 parts, or you contemplate the whole, so contemplate yourself as a corpse, visualize yourself if you die, what will you look like? See your own body in a state of decomposition over time, as it goes stiff and cold and changes colour. You can contemplate your body as the four elements. If you're doing the corpse meditation, then really get familiar with seeing your body in the state of decomposition. You know, visualize that, become familiar with those images. When you have attraction arise in the mind, you have some desire, some sexual desire, or some attachment to a particular physical form or an image in your mind, then what it tends to do is take the samadhi away. It brings out more proliferation and you lose control of your mind. So keep practicing mindfulness to make the mind very firm under your control, and don't let these objects of the senses overcome it. You have to learn how to transcend all the five hindrances. So you have to be able to make your mind firm to do this. The Buddha said, if you're one who regularly falls into sense desire, sensual desire, desire for the body, your body, desire for others, then keep contemplating the 32 parts over and over again. Keep bringing up the asupa reflections over and over again. Venerable Yasa was someone who had practiced asupa greatly in the past. Before he was a monk, he lived a life of luxury, his parents were wealthy. In a previous life, he'd been a volunteer helping to collect corpses that nobody had, no relatives, people who had died, they didn't have relatives, so he went around collecting them up to perform cremations for them. There was one time he was burning a corpse, and the corpse wasn't really burning, it was on a pile of wood. There were flames there, but the corpse wouldn't break down in the flames. It wasn't burning because it had a lot of fat and gristle on it. So he took a stick and had to poke through the fat and gristle to make some space, break the body up a bit so that it would start to burn. And that presented him with a very powerful image of a burning corpse. We call it Ukaha Nimitta. A visual image that stuck very clearly in his mind. And that stayed with him in that life, and then came through into his last life as a bhikkhu. It was the basis for developing the first jhana based on this image. From a ukaha nimitta, you develop a patipaka nimitta, which you can develop jhana from. In his last life, as I said, he was born into wealth, he had servants, friends, lived a life of luxury, had parties and all kinds of material happiness. But there was that time where they'd had a party, an evening of music and entertainment, and everybody was asleep just in the main entertainment hall in the house. The dancing girls, the musicians, everyone was lying around, and he just had this image, seeing them all as corpses as they slept. And it gave him a great sense of nibbita, a sense of just being fed up with the world and the attachment to the world. And that's what led him to leave the house, go off looking for somewhere quiet to stay. He said, oh, the household life is just so burdensome, confusing, it's not peaceful at all. They went to the edge of the town and went up to Itipatana Marigadayawana, where the Buddha was staying, a nice, cool, peaceful forest. And in the early morning he met the Buddha sitting there, and the Buddha said to him, knowing what his mind was thinking, he said, oh, come and stay here, it's very peaceful, very quiet. And this is what he was looking for, so he had to bow down and got to know the Buddha, even though at that time he didn't know it was the Buddha, he was just interested by what he had said. And then the Buddha taught him the Dhamma, taught him the benefits of Dana and Sila, He said, even though the practice of dana and sila brings you a lot of happiness and will bring you a heavenly rebirth, even that kind of happiness is not certain yet. You're still stuck in samsara. So then he went on to explain to him about the benefits of nekama, renunciation of sensuality, renunciation of the world. The Buddha compared that somebody who's just left the world, even though they have some desire for nibbana, for ending suffering and attachment, but because they've only just recently left the world, then they're like, a bit like a wet log that you want to make a fire out of, but you just pulled it out of a river, put it on the bank. You can't yet set fire to it because it's still soaking wet. You have to let it dry out. The Buddha said it's like that. When we ordain, we have to let the mind dry out from its past attachment to sensuality. We have to give it time to settle down, calm down, dry out. And then as it's drying out, as it were, then the development of bhavana will go better and deeper, and we can make our mind more firm in samadhi. As long as the log is still wet, meaning our mind is still caught up in sensuality, well, you can't burn the log, you won't be able to make your mind one-pointed yet, because it's still obsessed with the objects of the senses. As long as we can't one-point the mind, then we won't yet fully develop wisdom either. So the whole process is a process of drying out, learning to let go of sensuality, renouncing sensuality. In India, where the Buddha taught the Satipatthana Sutta in the Gujarat Raja province, or state area, where Delhi is today, the Buddha saw that the people there were very suitable to be trained in mindfulness. Their past good karma meant that they received that teaching very well, and they would contemplate the 32 parts of the body regularly, just the ordinary householders and villagers in that area. He taught them to contemplate the body, to see the body in the body, waiting eye in the waiting eye, mind in the mind. He got everybody contemplating a different body part. Some people contemplated the bones, some people the blood, and so on. The result of this is that they develop great equanimity. And with this great equanimity, there's a great sense of dispassion, detachment for the world. No longer having the desire just to go around earning money and finding wealth, but also not caught into aversion and conflict either. So from developing the 32 parts of the body as a contemplation, they went on to develop the Asupa Bhavana, corpse contemplation, and became skilled in contemplating, well, what happens when we die, what happens to our body, becoming familiar with that perception, how our body becomes cold and stiff, the air leaves it, the warmth leaves it, it becomes something undesirable, unattractive. And once the fire element has gone from a body, then it's just something nobody wants to have anything to do with. It becomes cold to the touch, unpleasant, smelly. No one wants this. But actually, this is just the way the elements are. You know, we don't see it from our delusions, our attachments, we don't see it. But actually, that's the way of the elements. They're bound to degenerate. And this body is bound towards death. There's no way out of it. Whether you like it or not, that's what's going to happen. When the body dies, then, you know, it changes colour, it smells, the breath stops, the heat leaves it, the whole thing starts to bloat and swell up. Bacteria grows, you get all kinds of chemical changes going on. You get insects and animals, small animals come to feed on the body. Worms arise, maggots, worms, they grow and they keep growing, gradually digesting the various internal parts of the body. In the end, all you're left with is, you know, a bunch of bones with a little bit of skin attached to them. Even then, they will start to break up and scatter as the four elements separate back to their original form. You can see, really, it's just a human life. It's a story of the four elements. You know, the four elements come together at conception, form into the embryo in the mother's womb. And what in the mother's womb, the embryo feeds on the blood of the mother. Then as the mother gives birth to the child, it feeds on the breast milk of the mother, then soft food, and then as it grows, starts to eat more solid food. This is really just an affair of the four elements, isn't it? As the body's growing, it's just absorbing the four elements and growing with them, but still very fragile. And the breath is something very fragile. If we just stop breathing for a few minutes, then we'll be dead. And we can go without food for quite a long time. We can go without water for some days. But if we don't have breath, just a few minutes and the body stops functioning. And that's how fragile a human life is, and how these four elements are so linked with fragility in that sense. So really, we're close to our death all the time. We're just a few minutes away from death, a few minutes without breath. So this is what we mean by contemplating, using mindfulness and wisdom to contemplate, to see the true nature of this body, the way it is, how it looks, its ugly, repulsive side, how it is, and its nature as impermanent, not self. The word prat, we say in Thailand, means that which is holy or venerable. Really what it means is that which is beyond attachment. So the mind of the prat or the samana, the monk, is the mind, you know, a true monk, a true samana, is beyond attachment. If the mind still sees the body as something to attach to, something that is a self to be held on to and, you know, blindly held on to, then the mind will remain dark. You know, attachment darkens the mind, blinds the mind. Mindfulness and insight brightens the mind and releases it from suffering. So the stronger our mindfulness and insight, then the less attachment there is bothering. Most of us, you know, we're born into the world, we're just obsessed with form. The physical form we have, the physical form of others. And this is what keeps us being reborn in the world over and over again. But as we develop the path, Sila Samadhi Panya, then the mind becomes, you know, more refined in its awareness, more refined in its understanding. At the very least, it might attain a heavenly rebirth, which has freed itself from some of the coarser defilements. And going on from that action, actually can attain the Arya path and Nibbana. Even though we talk about this practice, we talk about the contemplation of the body to see the unattractiveness, the repulsiveness of the body, and so on. Of course, it doesn't mean to say we just give up on life. We just walk around in rags or naked, and we don't eat and don't sleep and we don't look after the body. We still look after it. But this is an internal contemplation that we keep developing. You look at the people in the time of the Buddha, someone like the lady Visakha. Externally she was well-dressed, attractive person, but inside she'd seen the asupra, she'd seen the unattractive, impermanent nature of this body. One who's practicing like this, they're constantly developing this reflection. You might be developing, for instance, the mantra, Atikang Patikulang, the bones are repulsive, using it as a barikama, just over and over again, bringing the mind back to that, Atikang Patikulang, Atikang Patikulang. This will counter that sensual desire and lust that keeps arising. If our character is one and we keep falling into anger and negativity, then use a lot of metta bhavana. Keep developing the perception of goodwill, kindness, to counter that. In the end, you know, we're developing samadhi, whether we talk about samatha or vipassana samadhi, insight coming out of samadhi. The aim is always to cut off Kilesa, finally uproot and cut them off, not simply to set them aside or temporarily quell them, quench them, but actually our aim is to uproot and cut them off. And to do that we really have to make the mind firm, so this is why the development of samadhi is a very essential part of the practice. As I mentioned, you can develop samadhi and use it for all kinds of other things, for the performance of miracles, psychic powers, knowing people's state of mind, and so on. But really the point of it is to cut off the defilements and end suffering. A well-trained mind will lead to great benefit and lead to the arising of insight, understanding. When mindfulness and insight is firmly established, the mind will always be separating between rupa and nama. It will always be seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta phenomena, physical phenomena, mental phenomena. So keep developing this, keep developing, practicing sincerely, and little by little you'll find you will get results from the practice. As Sangha members, we're basing our practice on this practice of nekamma. Our practice of Sila, the Vinaya, the Patimokkha, this is Nekama in practice. We're refining our sense of renunciation and detachment from the world through body, speech and mind. You could say we're all children or offspring of the Buddha, or in Buddha, the children of the Buddha. So this is our responsibility, our duty to practice, to keep letting go of, cutting off kilesa. So I'll end the talk here and bless you all. Thank you.